This is an article by McLuhan about 1960, where he reviews a book on Wyndham Lewis by Hugh Kenner, who was a student of McLuhan, and benefited a lot from McLuhan. Hugh Kenner went on to become a famous critic in the United States. He was a Canadian, but he moved to the States. So this is McLuhan appraising what Kenner points out in Kenner's book on Wyndham Lewis. Which book came out about 1958-59? I have that book. I even have this review, but this is convenient. Because somebody has posted it somewhere. It says, most of this book is devoted to the novels of Wyndham Lewis, and consequently to a discussion of characters, plots, and the Lewis theories of person, self, society, and the artist. It is an unfriendly book, but it also presupposes much familiarity with the work of Lewis. For the unprepared reader, the book is not likely to lead to a closer inspection of Lewis. That, however, one hopes may prove not to be the case. I remember Kenner wrote an article on Lewis in 1953, and McLuhan objected to it. I think McLuhan doesn't like the direction Kenner has taken, even though they were close colleagues, and they both went to St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington in 1948. And on my father's birthday, June 4th, they met Ezra Pound together. So they had a past. So here is McLuhan saying, Lewis is in most respects the most eminent British painter of this century. His writings, Kenner admits, constitute, quote, the most astonishing literary career of the 20th century, unquote. Lewis is the man, quote, this is what he's quoting Kenner, Lewis is the man, quote, to whose mind the Cartesian split and the Nietzschean, that's Nietzsche, and the Nietzschean energy were not hobbies but lifeblood, unquote, and who, quote, was better equipped than anyone else to write out of inner knowledge the tragedy of his time, which would be the first half of the 20th century, unquote. Then McLuhan says, Lewis has this kind of representative importance. To an exceptional degree, his work is raised to the level of intelligibility, what T.S. Eliot described as the, quote, dissociation of sensibility, unquote, that set in late in the 16th century. McLuhan would later say, or around that time say, the dissociation of sensibility was caused by the printing press. Now here's Lewis. McLuhan's reviewing Lewis, and Lewis has already influenced McLuhan and Harold Innes to invent the discipline of media ecology. So keep that in mind. So then McLuhan says, for Lewis has accepted, along with W.B. Yeats, Ezra Pound, and T.S. Eliot, the doctrinaire premises which produce the Cartesian split. In a word, his triadic, means triangular, his triadic view of spirit, intellect, and sense is the Neoplatonic and Buddhist view of the opacity of the intellectual knowledge and the illusory character of the human self. So this would also include Gnosticism. The Gnostic Neoplatonic Buddhist view doesn't see much hope for intellectual knowledge and considers the self an illusion. So he's saying a lot of these vortices, Yeats, Pound, and Eliot, and Lewis, agree with this view. And then McLuhan says, in this view, Neoplatonic and Buddhist, there is no vitality or reality in mind or self or the world. But art is of the spirit, the divine spark in man, which is not the self in this doctrine. And art alone can impregnate the world with some quality of reality. Then McLuhan says about himself, I may not be untypical of most Catholics in having been slow to apprehend this matter. So I may not be untypical. So it's typical of Catholics to understand the role of art or to understand the role of Gnosticism. But the Romantics and the Symbolists, and the Romantics were the first Romantic revolution, that's Keats, Shelley, and those guys, and the second Romantics are the Parisians, Rambo, Baudelaire, others. So they're the second Romantics, in McLuhan's terms, and they're called the Symbolists. So he says, but the Romantics and the Symbolists, that covers the whole 19th century, necessarily regarded art as more real than the external world. The Catholic doctrine of the body-soul composite confers a substantiality on the existent such as it had in no other view, pagan or heretical. So he's saying the Catholic view is that the physical world is more real than any pagan philosophy or heresy or Buddhism. All pagan religion and philosophy reposes immediately or ultimately on the doctrine of pre-existence. That leads into the idea of reincarnation. The core of this doctrine is the notion that man imprisons an uncreated divine spark within his body and within his soul. But the human self is no more identical with this bit of a divinity within us than the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. So the human self is not connected to this spark of divinity, just as the spark of divinity is not in the stick or stone. But the imagination of the poet or genius is more nearly identical with this bit of divinity within us. So it's more identical, the imagination, than the same spark is identical with, what the heck? So he says the same thing. It's not the exact sentence, but then the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. So the human self is no more identical, but the imagination is more nearly identical. Then he repeats that phrase, if this is correct, with this bit of divinity within us, then the same spark is identical with a stick or a stone. The imagination of the poet or genius is nearly identical with this uncreated spirit. The least vision or action of the genius is thus more real than all the rest of existence. Then McLuhan says, these views flooded, these Gnostic views flooded into Europe in the 15th century. It's interesting, we just had LaRouche speak. LaRouche would take the same view as McLuhan here, basically an anti-Gnostic view. These views flooded into Europe in the 15th century. They underlie all the mechanic materialisms from Descartes to John Dewey. John Dewey was an educational philosopher, first half of the 20th century. Since it is the merest whim whether these views are used to structure a Berkeleyan idealism, that's Berkeley, or a, 1800s, say, 1700s, or a Darwinian mechanism. So, since it is these, they underlie all the mechanic materialisms. Now, McLuhan's not for mechanic materialisms. From Descartes to John Dewey, since it is the merest whim whether these views are used to structure an idealism or a mechanism, a Darwinian mechanism. In this respect, Thomas Hobbes, he was the philosopher who said might is right. In this respect, Hobbes was no more a materialist than Marx. Both regarded matter as an irreducible mental state. But mental states might well change with some rearrangement of the cosmic powers or eons. And it is the business of the artist to be constantly shifting the scenery of existence about, shifting about, in accordance with his infallible intuitions of the cosmic weather. Art is revolution. So that's this view. In this respect, Hobbes was no more a materialist than Marx. Both regarded matter as an irreducible mental state, that mental states might well change with some rearrangement of the environment or cosmic powers or eons. And it's the business of the artist to imitate that shifting. So it could be that the medium as a message is a Gnostic idea. Certainly media cause revolution. So art is revolution. McLuhan says media are art forms. Then he says this is also the Coleridgean or Samuel Taylor Coleridge notion of imagination. Fancy is for Coleridge. The imagination is understood merely in the tradition of Christian philosophy. The creative imagination in the Christian tradition is an intellectual power, not a superhuman emanation from spirit, spirit in quotes, or from the uncreated dark spark in the human soul. Okay, so he's now saying the non-Gnostic view, which is that the creative imagination in the Christian tradition is an intellectual power, not, as he said earlier, intellectual knowledge is opaque. So it is, it's an intellectual power, but is not a superhuman emanation from spirit or from an uncreated divine spark in the human soul. So McLuhan's laying out what he tends to believe, and he's saying Coleridge has a similar Gnostic notion, but it's within the Christian tradition. On the other hand, Lewis, like Eliot, Yeats, and Pound, the vortices, assumed the Pythagorean and Neoplatonic doctrine of spirit and imagination as a divine or superhuman power. That's not the Christian view. This power is no part of the human soul or intellect, but merely imprisoned there. The tragedy and comedy of the human condition is a result of the juxtaposition of this divine spark juxtaposed with matter, sense, and intellect. A familiar existentialist conception necessarily involving the doctrine of pre-existence. So the Gnostic says there is a tragedy and comedy of the human condition, and it's a result of the juxtaposition of this split, separate divine spark with matter, sense, and intellect. And that leads to existentialist ideas and involving the doctrine of pre-existence. Lewis makes great and grim comedy of the horror of spirit shackled to the dying animal or human body. His own point of view in comedy is expressed as opposite to Henry Bergson's when Lewis says that laughter results from the spectacle of things, that is, persons, trying to behave as though they were alive. Bergson found the key to laughter in persons behaving as though they were things. Bergson had not the courage of his own philosophical position. And it's precisely the courage of Lewis in pushing the Cartesian and Plotinian, that's about 300 AD, Plotinus, that's Gnostic, pushing the Cartesian and the Plotinian angelism to the logical point of the extinction of humanism and personality that gives his work such importance in the new age of technology. For, on the plane of applied science, we have fashioned a Plotinian world culture which implements the non-human and superhuman doctrines of Neoplatonic angelism to the point where the human dimension is obliterated by sensuality at one end of the spectrum and by sheer abstraction at the other. So McLuhan is saying that the electronic technology are making a Gnostic world, or making people think it's unreal, as the Gnostic philosophy had done for thousands of years. This situation became so evident to Lewis in 1920 that he devoted the next two decades to warning us about and explaining the anti-human nihilism emanating from modern philosophy and physics. So McLuhan's saying that Lewis is a Gnostic, but he's against the Gnosticism that's happening around him, as well as, okay, emanating from modern philosophy and physics, as well as our everyday activities in commerce and social engineering in this century. Lewis's political and social analysis pursued a humanist course, but his art remained on the plane of the doctrinaire superhuman level of abstract art and Neoplatonic spirit. So Lewis is sort of split in his own activities. His intellectual analysis of society is not Gnostic. It's against the Gnostic effect of technology, but his art is Gnostic. Lewis's uncompromising exposés of nihilism in the time philosophers, like James Joyce, Bergson, and the positivists. The positivists are the regular accepted mainstream scientists. His uncompromising expose of nihilism in their work went parallel with an artistic nihilism which gave spiritual force to his humanist pamphleteering, and spiritual is in quotes. So his expose of nihilism in the technological environment and the thinkers of that environment went parallel with an artistic nihilism which gave spiritual force to his humanist pamphleteering. The result was that his double talk, so there's a double talk contradiction, angered elites who were playing the same games, while his art frightened the ordinary public. So Lewis frightened the ordinary public, and his complex essays angered the elites who were playing the same games of double talk. So then he brings up the novel that Lewis had done that year. Well, if this book comes out, no, this book, I know Hugh Kenner met Lewis in 57. So that's before he did the book. So I'm not sure when this book was done, 58, 59, 1960. But Lewis himself did a novel in 1954 about his stay in Toronto and subsequently St. Louis, United States. I don't know if that's Missouri or Kansas. During World War II, because Lewis was in exile. He exiled himself because he knew he might be arrested in London for apparent Nazi sympathies. So this book is called Self-Condemned, and it's about, a good chunk of it is about his relationship with Marshall McLuhan. So here's McLuhan mentioning a book where McLuhan is a character in the book. And I was just talking to Ben Pelton. He has bought the book. Ben occasionally calls in here, and Ben is reading Self-Condemned. So McLuhan in this review says, a case in point is Lewis's current novel, Self-Condemned, which is set in Toronto and at Assumption College in Windsor. I think that may be the college that Chad went to. It became the University of Windsor. Chad lived in this area around Windsor. Lewis's central character, René, meaning reborn, and also my father's name, René Harding, flees the success that he's won in England as a historian and sets out on a quest of self or soul annihilation. So that would be a Gnostic trend. René thus defies the gods in the manner of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. And I quote the Ancient Mariner in my book, Fatty Communion, where McLuhan says about him and Ted Carpenter, quoting the Ancient Mariner, we were the first to burst into that silent sea. So Lewis, so the character René Harding, based on Wyndham Lewis, he refuses to accept his full term or sentence in the human condition. So he's not accepting his Gnosticism, I guess. He willfully seeks the subhuman conditions of a colonial metropolis, that's Toronto, as a means of freeing himself from the merely human fetters of comfortable English life. So we're talking about Lewis, the character René Harding, willfully seeks the, quote, subhuman conditions of Toronto as a means of freeing himself from the merely human fetters of comfortable English life. This annihilation pattern of spiritual metamorphosis, which can be an idea that people think they get from Ion. This annihilation pattern of spiritual metamorphosis is the plan of all the novels of Wyndham Lewis. Usually, however, it is failure. Yeah, they all end in some kind of tragedy. It is failure, driving the self to some sham existence to ensure security and livelihood. Read that again. Usually, however, it is a failure, driving the self to some sham existence to ensure security and livelihood that spurs his characters to extinction. But for Lewis, to exist humanly is to be a failure. Now, that's what Ion says on the surface. You humans are silly, and we don't advocate you to remain human. So you can see why devout Catholics would think that Ion is a raving Gnostic. But I would say Ion is not a Gnostic. But back to this point. Another novel that Lewis did in 1937 called The Revenge for Love is often called Lewis's best novel. It was about the Spanish Civil War. So he finishes talking about Self-Condemned. That's a 1954 novel. He goes back to The Revenge for Love and says, The Revenge for Love was to have been called False Bottoms. That powerful work, like The Apes of God, another book by Lewis, which deals with the occult world in London, the Bloomsbury Group, Aleister Crowley kind of characters. That powerful work, like The Apes of God, is a presentation of the English art world and of left-wing revolution, which was common in the 20s, which reveals the shams and false bottoms of all popular and human fronts whatever. Now, McLuhan says a Catholic, and he's a Catholic, can read such books with approval insofar as he finds them a revelation of the hollowness of merely human hopes. But it's necessary to recognize that for Lewis, as for the great pagan tradition of Neoplatonism and Gnosticism, existence as such is the ultimate sham. To exist is damnation. To exist humanly is to be self-condemned or damned to the material incarnation of selfhood. It just happens, says McLuhan, that in the new age of technology, when all human arrangements from the cradle to the grave have taken on the hasty extravaganza aspect of a Hollywood set, or you would say virtual reality, see, and Lewis and McLuhan are saying this 20 to 40 years before the phrase virtual reality. So all human arrangements from the cradle to the grave have taken on the hasty extravaganza aspect of a Hollywood set. The nihilist philosophies of Neoplatonism and Gnosticism have come into their own. So McLuhan is saying the medium is very unreal, and it makes people feel comfortable with philosophies of unreality. It's not a Catholic philosophy. So McLuhan continues with the beliefs of Gnosticism and perhaps Lewis. Existence is an empty machine, a cheap artwork, they have always said, the Gnostics have always said. The soul is a shabby mechanism, the body a monstrous one, a monstrous mechanism. The spirit or artist says to body and soul, a plague on both your prisons. And now in the 20th century, when nature has been abolished by art and engineering, when government has become entertainment, and entertainment has become the art of government, think of the Kardashians, and not the Renner sisters. Now the Gnostic and Neoplatonist and Buddhist can gloat. All right, so at this point in the 20th century, this is written 60 years ago, when nature has been abolished by art and engineering, they don't teach you that in high school, when government has become entertainment, and entertainment has become the art of government, they might say that nowadays. Now the Gnostic and Neoplatonist and Buddhist can say and gloat, quote, I told you so. This gimcrack mechanism is all that there ever was in the illusion of human existence. Let us rejoin the one, unquote. So that idea of merging with oneness or the monad is a Gnostic impulse. So then McLuhan says, this pagan unworldliness carried to its ultimate mystical point is what makes the work of Lewis so intense and his evaluation so fearless. This pagan unworldliness carried to its ultimate mystical point is what, and becoming an environment, is what makes the work of Lewis so intense and his evaluation so fearless. Remember, McLuhan said that his work was kind of he got a lot of it from Lewis. The many who share Lewis's philosophy but who have lacked the courage to live or express it, he has pilloried and derided in the greatest satires in our language. I mean, remember, you guys haven't heard anything of Lewis. They don't tell you about it in school. The greatest satires in our English language are provided by Lewis, and you can't even buy a Lewis book today. Maybe a used book, but the publisher of Lewis books in the 80s, Black Sparrow Press, in the early 90s, went bankrupt, and Ginkgo Press took over, but they're not publishing Lewis books as of yet. They are publishing McLuhan's book, but not much is coming from Lewis, so it's pretty hard to get Lewis books. Okay, so the many who share Lewis's philosophy but who have lacked the courage to live or express it, he has satirized, pilloried, and derided in the greatest satires in our language. They have had their revenge. Let's see. All right. These people that Lewis makes fun of, these budding Gnostics, these guys who like the idea that the virtual reality is supreme, they have had their revenge, but too easily. They cheat. I put in the words cheat. But too easily, for they control the press and all the means of artistic reputation. So they have suppressed Wyndham Lewis. It is hoped that Hugh Kennard's survey of Lewis's literary emanations will obtain him some serious attention. And that's the end of the review. It's called Nihilism Exposed, Nihilism as a Philosophy and as an Environment. And it says it comes from the Catholic journal Renaissance, 1955. So how the heck did Kenner write this book? I always thought it was written in 54, but I kept thinking that, no, he was with Kenner, he was with Lewis just before Lewis died in 57, so it must be a second visit by Kenner. Or, no, Kenner hadn't met him, but wrote about him in 54, and then met him personally just before he died. Isn't this the most unique bunch of knowledge you've ever heard of?
Well, I think I just caught the tail end of it. But yeah.
Okay. Well,
I like the part about the simulation.
Right. So you could study this, Leon and Kate and Sean and Martin. I could probably post this review on Dupes, but it is a big mouthful. Can you see that? Can you see that this is... Did you understand it?
I didn't get it. I had to go back over it.
All right. What do you say, young lady from L.A.?
I understood parts of it, but not the whole thing.
Well, I'm glad you guys didn't understand it, because that's why I think it's valuable. It's something to reread and get the subtleties and the distinctions. What I explained helps you get that. I don't think you would have a clue what was being talked about if you didn't have my supplements. But you have to see that most of you are Gnostics. The Gnostic view is what riddles our culture. You don't find reality very interesting. And then if you realize it's a media reality, you find it ridiculous, even though it's real because you got to make a living in it. But this detachment, most people favor the Buddhist view nowadays. They don't like the Catholic view.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's interesting. This is a criticism of certain effects that ION, you could assume, means. But I know that ION does not. Ion would agree with McLuhan, even though on the surface, Ion sounds like a raving Gnostic. But you have to go into Ion to get the differences. So, when Mark Stallman calls up and he starts accusing us of being dupes of a Gnostic philosophy, we'll have Ion respond to him and explain to him how wrong he is. But Mark, he's already called this phenomenon here. Raving Gnosticism, which Mark Stallman as some kind of Catholic person objects to. And he liked Wyndham Lewis, because he picked up the anti-Gnostic part of Wyndham Lewis. But I don't know what Mark would say about Lewis being a Gnostic. Just more complexities.